The background of this talk is I need to include mentioning my study in film theory and criticism, which is what I did my undergraduate work in, and my love of the medium of film. Because I'm going to say some things about the limitations of images and image-based communication, I don't want to give the impression that I think it's entirely useless or anything like that. But I do think that we ought to give some attention to the kind of overall effect of images replacing words as dominant modes of communication. Words are still there, but I think, as I'll try to make clear, that we do have a kind of preference for images, or images are given the benefit of the doubt and certainly have a prominence in our communication that they have perhaps never have had because of the technologies that we have that enable us to convey images across great distances. I was preparing to speak at a church recently, and I received a call from one of the organization's planners. We were making some of the practical plans, and he asked if I was going to use PowerPoint or any presentation software, and I said that I didn't plan to, and he said that one of the participants had specifically asked, because as the participant said, he was a visual learner and apparently didn't want to listen to an unaccompanied lecture, a lecture unaccompanied by images. Now, I understand that it's hard to pay attention to a lecture. I'll say that before I begin talking for 70 minutes. Especially since we have in our culture very few occasions to listen deliberately for long periods of time, unless you're in a classroom. A few generations ago, even relatively uneducated people could listen literally for hours to lectures and sermons and remain engaged. But we don't have those kinds of habits, and our speakers don't have the rhetorical skills such habits encourage, I will confess. Visual supplements can assist an oral presentation, although I've sat through a lot of PowerPoint presentations that really were beside the point, kind of missed the point, and really kind of distractions. But they can supplement. I've seen some brilliant PowerPoint, including Jeremy Begbie, who's a musician who has the best use of power. He ought to get some award for this. They gave out awards for this. I don't think that the person that that expressed this concern could accurately say he was a visual learner. At best, he may require that the written word be present on an image, the word-made image, if you will. But visual learning suggests that images actually teach something. Images, I don't think, really teach anything. Images make an argument. Images represent reality in powerful ways and in I think, very important ways. But images cannot come to conclusions. They can't make demands. They can't be judged as true or false. I have a whole chapter in All God's Children where I look at how visual syntax works in film and television and basically point out what it lacks. In saying it can't make demands, there's no subjunctive in images. You may be able to construct a narrative so that a kind of duty is implied. But it's often the case that people miss those kinds of points. Images can do many things, but they must be interpreted. Images without the word cannot teach. Now, there are many consultants today who advise churches that worship services need to be more visual. And the reason they give for that is that we're living in a culture where people are more engaged by visual communication than by verbal communication. Well, there may be good reasons to involve our sense of sight in worship. And I do think that there's a tendency in some Protestant churches to a kind of Gnostic asceticism, as if the sense of sight was inherently wrong, as if we were kind of angelic brains who only had ears and no other sense of sight. So there are some good reasons to involve our sense of sight, but the fact that we live in a visually based culture isn't one of them, I would argue, in a kind of a cussed way, because that argument ignores the question of why, as a culture, we have become more engaged with images than with words, and what some of the consequences are of that style of engagement, of that form of engagement, what some of the consequences are of what Jacques Ellul labeled years ago the humiliation of the word. I think it's very important on this issue, as on many others, for pastors particularly, for church leaders to be aware of significant cultural trends, not so that we can exploit them to increase market share or piggyback our efforts on those trends. But I think it's important so that we may be alert to pastoral opportunities that dominant cultural conventions bring about. People who are alienated from language are suffering a great loss. It's a loss of a great blessing in human life, and it's a blessing that peculiarly links us to God, who speaks the word, speaks his word and speaks creation into existence. A God who is the Word. In being alienated from language, we're also alienated from a blessing that links us with each other and with creation. Adam's first task is to name things, to have a linguistic relationship with creation. The loss of a love of language, and under that, a love of literature and poetry, things that we do with language as God's creatures. That's not just a neutral cultural change. It's not like people now prefer pastels to earth tones. It's not in that category. This is a qualitative problem that I would suggest is a dehumanizing cultural decline, and one about which we can't just be rather glib and say, oh, let's make adjustments. For the church to add its blessing to the dominance of visual communication at the expense of the verbal is to add momentum to the world's confusion about the shape of what constitutes well-lived human life. And what we should be doing is offering a life-giving alternative to that confusion. The message of the gospel is about spiritual renewal, but it's a spiritual renewal that involves a transformation of all of life. We can't neatly sever spiritual life from the life of the body. Even Jesus fasted. Even Jesus went apart to pray. Jesus is spiritual. You think if anybody has a spiritual life together, it would be our Lord. Jesus had to practice an embodied spirituality. What he did with his body mattered to his spiritual life. What he did in space and time mattered. Because we're integrated as body and soul, conversion to the way of Jesus will have consequences for how we configure our embodied life. And it has consequences for the life of the senses. Discipleship, we're called to make disciples. I've said that a few times since I've been here. Not called to make converts. We're called to make disciples, and disciples should be people who are better listeners, on average, than non-disciples, especially in our time. People who are at least as much at home with verbal as with visual communication. Disciplers should be aware of what verbal communication can convey that visual communication can't, and know that there's some knowledge which is essential to Christian faithfulness for which verbal attentiveness is essential. And for pastoral reasons, I think it's important to have some understanding of how the rise of a visually dominated culture and the decline of active and creative participation in the life of the Word through artful speech, through literature, and through poetry has made possible, if not inevitable, a number of other social pathologies. That's what I'm going to try to focus on this lecture. Exhibit A, Your Honor. In 2004, the National Endowment for the Arts released a study. You can download a PDF file with the entire study, 60 pages, the results of the study, called Reading at Risk, a survey of literary reading. And basically what the National Endowment for the Arts was interested in is how much fiction do American adults read? Oh, and what is the trend line for the reading of fiction? And Interestingly, they were generous. This was not how many people still read Jane Austen or Dickens or Shakespeare. If you read Danielle Steele, if you read Tom Clancy, if you read a story, I don't know, in Playboy, that would probably qualify for reading fiction. How many people read any work of fiction in the course of a year? The survey results indicated that in 1982, 56.9% of people surveyed, 56.9%, read some work of literature, novel, short story, poetry, or a drama, in the course of a year. 56.9. In 1992, 10 years later, it had dropped to 54%. But in 2002, again, a 10-year increment, it had dropped to 46.7%. Almost a 20% drop in the course of 20 years. And the trend line is getting steeper. It's really a remarkable figure. When it's broken down to 18 to 24-year-olds, which would include a lot of students, the numbers are even starker. In 82, it was 59.8%. In 92, 53.3%. Again, a drop, but not that big. In 2002, 42.8%. More than 10% drop in 10 years. Reading any work of fiction in the course of a year. A 17-point slide over the course of 20 years. There's been quite a lot of analysis of this, provided, first of all, by the National Endowment for the Arts, and then there's a wonderful forum discussion, which you can download from the Association of Literary Scholars and Critics, who talk about what this means, not just for their jobs. Obviously, these are people who teach literature. They have a stake in this. But also for society at large. And I would argue that this is should be a diaconal concern of the church. I said in one of my talks that we ought to be concerned for figurative widows and orphans. That when James says that we're to care for widows and orphans in their distress, they're not just literal widows and orphans. James's wisdom literature. This is a really concise summary of our obligation. I would argue that any person cut off from some good that God has made as part of life, some blessing that is part of our humanity, that those people cut off from that good are figurative widows and orphans. I doubt that I'm going to hear a sermon anytime soon about these results. And yet, I would argue that the kinds of things we do hear laments about from pulpits in terms of moral decline and loss of community and loss of committed relationships and those sorts of things, divorce, that they're not unrelated to this decline in the kinds of capacities that are engaged and exercised as one is committed to the work of literature. Another thing I would mention, someone I interviewed a couple years ago, this is definitely on my top 10 list of books that I think nail some aspect of contemporary cultural confusion. John McWhorter, who is a linguist who taught at Berkeley for a number of years, a book he wrote called Doing Our Own Thing, the subtitle, The Degradation of Language and Music and Why We Should Like Care, which is a wonderful study in the loss of oratory, the loss of formal speech patterns, the loss of a kind of ethic of formality in speech patterns in the relatively recent past in American culture. And as a linguist, he studied many, many cultures, from really primitive cultures to advanced cultures. He argues that American culture is the first society that he knows of that has lost a kind of twin register between formal and informal speech, to the point now that almost all speech aspires to the informal, to the casual, just as a lot of other aspects of our lives aspire to the casual and informal, not simply speech. And he suggests that this is, doesn't just suggest, he argues strongly, that this is a reflection of our suspicion of authority. that this is one of the outcomes of the last 4 decades campaign against authority and for individual autonomy. So again, I would argue that if we believe we have a message that implies something about the nature of authority, particularly the authority of God to judge people, but also something about the nature of the authority of parents, the authority of government, the authority of the church, the authority of Scripture, for the church to say, you know, people have a problem with formal speech, so preaching really ought to be as informal as possible. Again, I want to raise questions. Are we adding momentum to a cultural symptom which conveys and reflects suspicion about authority? If McWhorter is right, I think that we are. So those are just two instances that portray a change in our attitude toward language. I could cite the decline in the last 30 years with interest in poetry. Dana Gioia, who's currently the head of the National Endowment for the Arts, wrote a famous piece published in the Atlantic Monthly, I believe, about, goodness, now 15 years ago, documenting how much less interest there is in poetry among educated people, the people whose educational and socioeconomic background used to qualify them as likely interested in poetry, how that's just kind of gone away. And he suggests, as does McWhorter, that part of what is happening is we no longer have the love of language well used that has been characteristic in the past and still is characteristic in some cultures. I want to offer some raw material toward, first of all, in looking at this, unpacking this, toward a theology of word and language. And then I want to look at ways in which verbal communication differs from visual language, and then finally some comments about the relationship between a preoccupation with images that characterizes 20th century culture with the rise of the movies and then of television. The relationship between that kind of preoccupation with what we might call a preoccupation with looking good, a preoccupation with style, sheer style, and the projection of a persona through art, through visual artifacts, and the concomitant loss of a concern with character as image becomes more important than any kind of internal reality. First, and this will have to be necessarily very abbreviated, and you could do this yourself. You all have concordances, and you probably have books that actually talk about this sort of thing. The biblical view of language is remarkable from beginning to end in so many details. First of all, as I alluded, the fact that God speaks reality into existence, then gives Adam a linguistic task of naming. Naming becomes a very, very important theme throughout Scripture, and the name of God is presupposed to have power. Of course, we know when Moses encounters God in the burning bush, a lot of that conversation is about his name. What is his name? But throughout the Scriptures, Old Testament and New Testament, we see the idea that the name of God, the linguistic appellation of God, is tied to God's person himself. Throughout the Psalms, we see this. We see this in the New Testament, where we're told to baptize in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. We see it in prayer when we are commanded to pray in the name of Jesus. We see this in Christ's, particularly in his miraculous work, but particularly in his healing work, when he speaks a word of life, and it happens. And of course, most famously, perhaps, is the prologue to John's Gospel, where the second person of the Trinity is identified as the Word, so that the speech of God becomes identified with God. The And again, throughout the New Testament is this emphasis that that it's the name of Jesus that becomes a kind of powerful presence. That would suggest that language is not, again, just a kind of evolutionary convention. I think we're living in a time when we're tempted, even those of us who are suspicious about Darwinism, are tempted to kind of accept a kind of naturalistic assumption about various aspects of human nature and human experience and human cultures, suggesting that language is just something we evolved. It's clear that from the scriptures that that when we ascribe linguistic capacity to God, that we're not being anthropomorphic. I would suggest that instead the better way to understand it is that we speak because God is a speaking being. We are theomorphs, after all. We're created in the image of the Word, so we're created after a template of a speaking God. And so rather than, as some religious historians have suggested, rather than asserting that, oh, well, this talk about God's speech, that's just a human way of understanding something that's mysterious, I would suggest rather that, in fact, we speak. And that the thing that speech is, the thing that language is between human beings and between man and God, is something that has a divine quality about it. It has a particularly transcendent quality about it. Now, that's my whirlwind raw material. I'm going to let you do all the hard work and the heavy lifting in developing this because you're smart and you're seminary students, so you should be able to do this. And I'm just a journalist, so I don't know all the ins and outs. You can do the Greek and all the Hebrew and everything. But I hope it's at least plausible to you that a concern for language isn't just a kind of arbitrary cultural concern, but in fact that speech does have this deeper significance about it. Now, I want to talk real quickly about how words communicate in ways that images don't. I alluded to this at the beginning. The meanings of words can be explained in other words and sentences, and that's one of the things preaching is where we take a set of words and then we say other words about them in order to develop the understanding of them. Contrast that with how pictures are interpreted. Words can describe other things, but pictures really only present themselves. They can be assembled in a montage to suggest something beyond themselves. But it would be difficult to explain the meaning of a picture by showing another picture. Images, again, don't have that kind of power. The Declaration of Independence could be paraphrased and translated into other languages with a possible loss of something in translation. But try imagining the essence of, say, the Mona Lisa, that can't be conveyed precisely in images. You can't really paraphrase an image. You can express the same thought in different words, but it's difficult to express the same picture in different ways. This, by the way, is one of the things that I think makes film and the visual arts powerful, is precisely because they have a kind of specificity of presence about them that gives them a very different mode of communication from language. Pictures, images don't do a good job expressing abstractions like respect or duty or patriotism or God, which may be one of the reasons why the Second Commandment is there, because the image doesn't have the capacity to represent and convey the essence of something that isn't ultimately visual, that isn't, I'm not saying God is an abstraction, but God doesn't have an essentially a visual nature. Images are powerful conveyors of feelings and of expressiveness, although not infallibly. There's a famous study, I think I mentioned this in All God's Children, which I wrote when I was a very young man, as has been pointed out. People who study film history know about a famous experiment in the teens, I think it was, in Russia, The Russians were really at the cutting edge of thinking about film syntax. How do images convey? How do images communicate? And a film theorist named Lev Kuleshov performed an experiment where he got one of the best actors in Russia, who was known principally for his stage acting, to come in and to stand and just get a vivid expression on your face. He said, just try to look really emotional, but didn't tell him what kind of emotion. Look really emotional. And so they took this shot of this actor looking emoting, basically. Well, then they took that shot and they intercut it with three different images. They cut, I think one of them was a bowl of soup steaming. And one of them was an open coffin with an older woman in the coffin. And one was a group of children outside playing. And then they showed each of these three snippets with the actor cut away to the coffin, cut away to the actor. The actor cut away to the soup, cut back to the actor. Actor, kids, actor. They showed these three sequences to audiences. And all of the audiences, separate audiences, marveled at what expressiveness there was in this actor's face. How he expressed grief. Oh, no, joy. Oh, hunger. No, that's what it was. So the same sheer emoting was interpreted in context as being an entirely different set of emotions. It's indicative of the fact, one of the things the Russian editors, Russian theorists were brilliant at, is showing that the art of film is not the art of nicely composed images or well-constructed images. It's finally the art of editing. It's the art of context. It's the art of butting one image up against another and conveying a kind of conviction or concern that isn't in the image itself. But you can see, if that's the case, how a kind of precision with visual images just isn't possible. So the images are powerful conveyors of feelings and of expressiveness, but very ambiguously. Very ambiguously. So in the case of Kuleshov's experiment, there was a kind of emotional intensity, but the actual content of the emotion was kind of up for grabs, depending on what was in the surrounding shots, and I would argue, depending on what the audience brought, with the context of the audience's expectations. Joshua Myrowitz, who wrote a book called No Sense of Place, The Impact of Electronic Media on Social Behavior, observed that messages in television news tend to be about something different from those in print. Our response to a verbal message is often to ask whether it's true or false, whether the arguments are logical, whether it's well written. Print messages can be issue and concept related, but expressive messages on television often lead to a different response. They're more personal. They're tied to the speaker. Expressive messages constantly tell us something about the expressor's orientations to the situation, how they're feeling, what their emotional response to their own behavior is. I don't know of any studies to this effect, but I'd be willing to bet money that that TV journalists are more apt to ask someone who's just experienced something what they're to describe their feelings than a print journalist would be. Certainly, in terms of the amount of coverage of those sorts of things, the coverage tends to be more emotive because that's what images do. Well, so sight and speech do different things. Sight and the word do different things. And I'd recommend, this is a rather radical defense of the word, but it's kind of bracingly helpful, although I don't agree with all of it. I mentioned Jacques Ellul's book, The Humiliation of the Word. And he has some wonderful, wonderful insights into how sounds and particularly words convey the world to us differently than the way words do, differently than the way images do. He points out, for instance, and I hadn't thought of this until I read Ellul, that our sight positions us in space, but our hearing tends to position us in time. We're more attentive to the sequence of things. What comes next? What will we hear next? That's why a dripping faucet will drive you nuts in the middle of the night. It'll drive you more nuts than a flashing light will. Well, maybe not. You have a loose light bulb or something. But also, that's what music is. Music is the organization of sound through time. Music is a profoundly temporal art form. And we are oriented in time through sound. And we're oriented to, that's why I think, since the making of arguments requires a sequence of propositions, that language, which ultimately is oral, language is the way in which arguments are made. Image dominated forms of communication are very nonlinear, and hence they don't move from propositions to conclusions. I think that in a number of observers have been commenting on this for years, that that people living in an image-based culture are more indifferent to arguments than people who are very much at home in print. And again, to the extent that our preaching and the declaration of the gospel and the call of people to repentance must be propositional, that's essential. The expressiveness of images has some downsides. Again, I'm a big fan of film and hence of visual communication, but there are some significant downsides. This just appeared moments ago, actually. This appeared yesterday in the Chronicle of Higher Education, a study that's just been released by a woman who's associate professor of psychology at San Diego State, who just published a... she hasn't yet published it. She's coming out with a book called Generation Me, Why Today's Young Americans Are More Confident, Assertive, Entitled, and More Miserable Than Ever Before. Cheery title. She did a study called The Narcissistic Personality Inventory. How narcissistic are people? And she did, a longitudinal study between 1982 and 2006, asking such questions like, if I ruled the world, it would be a better place. Yes or no? True or false? I can live my life any way I want to. True or false? You know, all these questions which are measurements of narcissism. It's nice to know that these things can be measured. She worked with four other researchers, defines narcissism as excessive vanity and sense of entitlement. People who exhibit narcissism tend to lack empathy for others, behave aggressively when insulted, and ignore the needs of those around them. She maintains that one of the mechanisms, one of the appliances which has conveyed the sense of narcissism, she believes, are things like YouTube or MySpace. I alluded to that during our panel discussion yesterday, where everybody becomes their own press agent. That's not the only thing she talks about, but she does talk about that sense of creating an image for oneself in public as one of the promoters of this sense of narcissism. Again, I want to underline that we can't just abstract image-based communication from its social context. We can't just say people are now more interested in images, therefore the church should have more images, without paying attention to what, in real life, what have the consequences of this fascination been, and what is it linked to. Culture is an ecosystem. I said the other day it's more like an ecosystem than an encyclopedia. An encyclopedia, you can read one article in isolation from the others, although there's probably cross-references in them. But you can't really understand culture without understanding all these other pieces that are part of it. And so you can't minister to people in that culture by taking one aspect of their lives out of context and not paying attention to how it influences all the other aspects of their lives. Now I want to move on to talking about the relationship between images with the culture of celebrity, which has a number of presents a number of difficulties to ministry and to the church's discipleship. There's a book called The Image written in 1961 by Daniel Boorstin, who went on to become Librarian of Congress, a well-known cultural historian. And Boorstin asserted in that book, two centuries ago, when a great man appeared, people looked for God's purpose in him. Today we look for his press agent. The subtitle of Boorstin's book is A Guide to Pseudo-Events in America. And I'll explain what he means by pseudo-events in a minute, but he described celebrities as human pseudo-events. The celebrity is a person who's well-known for his well-knownness. All those people on Hollywood Squares, for instance. Or Anna Nicole Smith, who was really well-known for having established a kind of presence. In contrast to heroes of an earlier day who were known for great deeds, often deeds of significance for public order, celebrities are made by the media. Boorstin's book was principally an analysis of what he calls pseudo-events, the sort of concoction that's the result of creative press releases rather than something that actually happened. And as I was rereading my notes this week, I thought of, we had a wonderful pseudo-event this week that the president of the seminary was involved with, the press conference that James Cameron and his friends had about this documentary that's coming up on the Discovery Channel or History Channel, I can't remember which, alleging to be the result of this great archaeological discovery of the casket ossuaries that held the bones of Jesus and his wife and child, so we're told. Now, this is a wonderful network of pseudo-events. You had a press conference. You had a Larry King appearance by the people on the press conference. And then you had a film that originally was the occasion for the press conference. And all of these things are kind of manufactured events because there's nothing new has really happened. I mean, archaeologists have known of these boxes for decades, I think at least since 1980, and most archaeologists have dismissed the claims and said this is nothing, there's nothing here. And this is a wonderful example. Boorstin would say, yeah, this is exactly the kind of thing that a pseudo-event is. And he suggests that more and more of American culture involves conversation and great concern given to a great emotional energy given to things that don't really happen. One of the examples I think he had in his book was during the Kennedy campaign in 1960. This book came out in 61. During the Kennedy campaign, Kennedy would release his speeches in advance to the press. And on one stop, he released the speech to the press and then gave a different speech. And the news headline wasn't what Kennedy said or how people reacted to it. It was that he diverted from his speech. That was the event. Well, that in a sense, they were just that wasn't the event. that was something that may have inconvenienced the press, and perhaps that's one reason why they got so upset about it and wrote a headline, because they felt, well, gee, here we had our stories all written based on the text we were handed. For the press, it may have been an event, but in terms of world history, it was not an event. And Boorstin thought a lot of. The reason the book is called The Image is because a lot of pseudo-events are tied up with image management. He wrote this long before the term photo-op was coined. And he saw some rather dark consequences for American public life because of this kind of image manipulation. One reviewer commenting on Boorstin's book, actually relatively recently, defined pseudo-events as manufactured spectacles designed to generate material for further manufactured spectacles, such as post-mortem commentary supplied by the employees of the news organizations that had produced the things in the first place. We see this all the time on CNN, where you know they have a documentary, and then they have their own people talk about the documentary, as if the documentary was like something like a hurricane or some real thing that happened. Boorstin was also concerned about the effect of pseudo-events on political life. That was his main concern. If we test presidential candidates by their talents on TV quiz performances, We will, of course, choose presidents for precisely these qualities. In a democracy, reality tends to conform to the pseudo-event. Nature imitates art. But it wasn't just about politics and image management. It was about larger questions of whether contemporary Americans preferred imagined reality to real reality. It was, in his own words, how we hide reality from ourselves. It's ironic in some ways because images have a great capacity to convey reality, to convey the texture of lived life in space and time. And yet he argues that the management of images, the purveying of images through mass media, actually becomes a way of hiding reality from ourselves. And he suggests that we then expect new and interesting things to become reported to us every day. We want to see a new thing every day. I'm reminded in the Christian tradition, at least as far back, I think, as Augustine, when John talks about worldliness being lust of the eyes, in the old translation, concupiscence of the eyes, Augustine, Aquinas, up through the contemporary period, a number of commentators have suggested that what that means is a desire to see new things. The essence of worldliness, according to the Apostle John, is channel surfing. The restless desire to see things that have a kind of fascination or titillation, as opposed to, as commentators have said, being a real person of vision. That the biblical idea of vision means perceiving reality as it is. But worldliness is a lust of the eyes, just an interest in seeing whatever happens to be there just for the sake of titillation in some way. Which is what I do when I'm sitting there with clicking channels. You know, I read somewhere that men do this more frequently than women. I don't know if your wives, if you're married, have complained about your habits with the remotes. But I'm told the reason for this is deep in gender difference, that men are always kind of prowling, looking for something fascinating and restless, whereas women will watch a bad program and try to nurture it into being better. That's why we love them. So we turn on television or log onto our favorite news site online. There's a sense in which we prefer interesting unreality to boring reality. We want something that will fascinate us. And we kind of become addicted to this. I know I do. And the Internet feeds that also. You know, how many times do I click on some site during the day hoping there's some new thing I can see, somebody's blog or some news site, thinking, oh, maybe now there's something that's interesting. And of course, the people who manage these things, they want me to come back a dozen times a day, so they create pseudo events. Borsten would recognize this. Now, decades after Daniel Borsten wrote this book, a cultural historian and film critic, Neil Gabler, wrote a book called Life the Movie, in which he echoed Borsten's concern that more and more Americans expected life to play out the way their favorite movies do. He writes near the end of the book, at one point in cultural history, we asked whether movies furnished an adequate likeness of real life. That is, are they realistic? The good movies were the more realistic ones. Now we ask of reality that it accommodate itself to film. The good person, like the good party, should be more movieistic. Or to put it another way, where we had once measured the movies by life, we now measured life by how well it satisfied the narrative expectations created by movies. And, of course, the most movieistic people are the people who star in movies. Actors. Celebrities. So the expectation that life be like a movie and the increasing cultural centrality of celebrities are really two sides of the same coin. There's a sense in which I think people are fascinated by the lives of celebrities because they're interested in the kind of script that their lives play out. People are interested, what will the next act? We're having a commercial break while Britney's in rehab, but what's going to happen after the commercials? What's the next act in putting the life story of Britney Spears together as if it were a kind of a docudrama? Gabler notes, while an entertainment-driven, celebrity-oriented society is not necessarily one that destroys all moral value, as some would have it, it is one in which the standard of value is whether or not someone can grab and then hold on to the public's attention. It is a society in which those things that do not conform, for example, serious literature, serious political debate, serious ideas, serious anything, are more likely to be compromised or marginalized than ever before. It is a society in which celebrities become paragons because they are the ones who've learned how to steal the spotlight, no matter what they have done to steal it. And at the more personal level, it is a society in which individuals have learned to prize social skills that permit them, like actors, to assume whatever role the occasion demands and to perform their lives rather than just live them. The result is that Homo sapiens is rapidly becoming Homo sonicus, man the entertainer. Now let's look for a minute at the idea about people performing their lives, because I think that many people have an increased sense, and a number of sociologists, cultural historians, have observed this, and some people have even said that this is part of the essence of the postmodern moment, is that people increasingly have a self-conscious sense that they're playing out a role, that they're playing a role. I mean, as early as Irving Goffman's book back in the 60s, The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life, there's been this kind of concern that this is something that modern culture encourages. I do think that, again, we are encouraged to have this sense for a variety of structural reasons in society. And because of that, I think celebrities do have a kind of more central role than they used to. About 10 years ago, we were getting ready to move into the house we're living in now. We'd bought a lot in a rural area, and I wanted to meet the neighbors who lived around us. And I went over to a very modest rambler on an adjacent lot to meet a man named Gary Lamb and his family. It was a Sunday afternoon. I knocked on the door, introduced myself and my wife. We were invited into their living room. The TV set was on. They didn't turn the set off, turned it down, but the races were on. So this is rural Virginia. It's NASCAR land. So the races were on. And Mr. Lamb was telling us a little bit about his family, where they came from, how many kids he had. And then he said, "We're Southern Baptists." And then, nodding at the television, "Of course, since we're Baptists, we're watching NASCAR," he said. Now, at the time, I thought it was pretty funny. Well, yeah, what did it mean? It struck me as remarkable the more I thought about it. Here's a man with a high school education. He's not reading Jacques Derrida. He's not reading postmodern theorists about a kind of self-consciousness and that kind of ironic detachment. But he had a keen self-consciousness about his cultural identity and called attention to it. A generation or two ago, Southern Baptists might have watched NASCAR unself-consciously. It's just what they did. It's not something they made remarks about, but it's just what came natural. But increasingly, we are very aware of the fact that we're kind of playing a role. We have a kind of awareness of our cultural situatedness, in part because we see we're more exposed to people playing other roles, kind of living out other lives than ever before. And so we do have a kind of self-consciousness. There's a book called Mediated by Thomas DeZengatita, who I interviewed several issues back on the journal. And he talks about how awareness of one's cultural setting used to be the prerogative of very few reflective individuals. But in the postmodern world, it's what most people feel. Being part of a culture traditionally meant accepting a set of taken-for-granted customs and habits, but not being aware that they were your culture. The sense in which we are now the fishes feeling wet, in a certain sense. And that taken-for-granted participation in a culture has a feeling of necessity. But once people acquire a certain kind of self-consciousness about what they're doing, they begin to feel that they're performing a role, not living a life. This is DeZengatita's argument. Life begins to have an ironic and constructed quality about it. It's not the living of a life, but the choosing of a lifestyle. Lifestyle, interesting word. DeZengatita reports in this book that he went to the Prospect Park Zoo in Brooklyn not long before he wrote the book. It's a building. There's a building there that has exhibits illustrating how various animals adapt to various ecological niches. There are flora and fauna from an alpine meadow, from a rainforest, from a desert, And the building is called the Hall of Animal Lifestyles. The thing about the word lifestyle, it suggests that we have options. So even animals have options. You know, you imagine some lemur or something deciding, this is my lifestyle. I kind of like a change. Move to a different kind of climate. So we assume that everything's about choices. That's the main one of the things that Dzen Gotita is concerned about, is that this notion that we all kind of play out a script, that we live out our script, means that we could live a different script. We could reject the script that we now have. And I want to suggest that that's linked to the culture of celebrity. It's linked to the mechanism of visual, of our preoccupation with image that visual communication makes possible. Again, it's part of that ecosystem. It doesn't have a kind of necessary effect, cause and effect relationship like you have with a mechanism. But given the kind of organism that culture is, these are the kinds of things that kind of work and have worked in time. There's a history to this. I think that it would be helpful to look at, I'm going to take a little bit of time to look at some of that history, because the history of the rise of publicity making and image manufacture is very much tied up with the history of the moving picture. So I want to take a little bit to look at how the movies have shaped that. Again, a preoccupation with images. Professional public relations and film technology arrive in American society at almost exactly the same time, and it's also the same time that huge numbers of people are moving from country and small towns into large anonymous cities. So in the late 19th, early 20th century, there's a huge migration from urban centers into urban centers from rural centers, that is, from places where pretty much everybody in town. You knew everybody around you, and they knew you better than you wish they knew you. No one living in a small town can create an image for themselves because everybody knows what they're really like. So image construction is kind of a stupid thing to do. But if you're living in a city where you're surrounded by all sorts of anonymous people and you can, give 30 days notice, move to a different apartment, move to a different neighborhood, create an entirely new script for yourself, as it were. In an urban setting, that kind of persona adjustment has some kind of plausibility and actually some kind of utility to it. Now, there's a classic essay on this that I'd encourage you all to read as part of your understanding of how we got to where we are. It's a book, an essay called Personality and the Making of 20th Century Culture. It's cited all the time in books on 20th Century Culture. Personality and the Making of 20th Century Culture, the author is Warren Sussman, S-U-S-M-A-N. The book it's in is called Culture as History, the Transformation of American Society in the 20th Century. And the really good news is that essay is available online. You don't even have to buy the book. Personality and the Making of 20th Century Culture by Warren Sussman. And this is an essay in which he develops this brilliant observation based on research, not just sitting around ruminating, that in the early 20th century, we moved from a concern for character as a way to cultivate one's person to a concern for personality. And he documents this through articles in popular books and magazines and booklets, pamphlets that were published. Advice and advice columns, that sort of literature, and he reviewed 200 such items in the late 19th century, and looked at all the key words that showed up. What words showed up more than others? What concepts are referred to? And the words that he finds are citizenship, duty, democracy, work, golden deeds, outdoor life, honor, reputation, morals, manner, integrity, and above all, manhood. These are addressed to young men. Manhood, with a kind of sense of virility and obligation that implies. The stress, as he writes, was clearly moral, and the interest was almost always in some sort of higher moral law. He says you begin to see the beginnings of a radical shift in the kinds of advice manuals that appear after the turn of the century to very new preoccupations which strike at the heart of the basis of the culture of character. the books that now show up, the pamphlets that show up, the words that show up are not, first of all, they're more adjectives than nouns, interestingly. And the words that show up are words like fascinating, stunning, attractive, magnetic, glowing, masterful, creative, dominant, forceful. And as he points out, these are adjectives that don't work really well with character. They would seldom, if ever, be used to adjust character. Character, as Sussman says, is either good or bad, but personality has these kinds of qualities about it. Personality is the quality of being somebody. That was a definition he found repeated in various ways in almost all the manuals he read. Of being somebody with a capital S. Being close to being famous, close to being a celebrity. And he said this is, he argues that this comes about in part because of social circumstances. We live now constantly in a crowd. How can we distinguish ourselves from others in that crowd? While the term is never used, the question is clearly one of life in mass society. The new personality literature stressed items that could be best developed in leisure time and represented themselves on emphasis on consumption. The social role demanded of all in the new culture of personality was that of a performer. Every American was to become a performing self. We did a documentary on the history of courtship in 20th century culture and found some other interesting things, and particularly advice manuals to young women, which used to talk about domestic skills and capacity to cook and sew and those sorts of things. And then around the same period, also talk about having a nice kind of personality, a kind of magnetic and attractive personality that someone could see immediately. In 5 seconds, they could kind of suss out what you were about. And one of the writers said, after all, you're not going to know him long enough for him to learn that you can make a really good apple pie. So what good does that do? Again, there's this kind of impersonal social setting that suggests that if you want to make your way in life, the way to do it is to cultivate more superficial qualities of character. Now, it's about the same time, as I indicated, that the first independent public relations firm was founded in Boston in 1900. And these firms were the product of a concern on the part of newly powerful industrial and corporate interests to improve their reputation. And John D. Rockefeller was one of the first beneficiaries of this new discipline, and he hired a man named Ivy Ledbetter Lee to cultivate a new image for him. He had the reputation of being a callous tycoon, and they wanted to give the impression to the public that he was a magnanimous benefactor. And Lee, in his own words, was a great practitioner in the art of getting believed in. The art of getting believed in. He, by the way, was a son of a Methodist minister, not that there's any necessary correlation between that and the art of getting believed in. Within 20 years, another leading practitioner of this new art, Edward Bernays, was teaching a course on public relations at NYU. In just 20 years, a brand new discipline and vocation has arisen, and there's already a course being taught at NYU. And Bernays argued that the PR man is, as he put it, not merely the purveyor of news, he is more logically the creator of news. As historian of journalism Michael Shudson has written, what had been the primary basis for competition among journalists, the exclusive, the inside story, the tip, the scoop, was whisked away by press releases and press conferences. And image management was born. Newspapers began to rely on PR people to get information to fill the pages that had to be printed and sold every day. Again, image management, 1923. This is a time when people are flocking to watch moving images in Nickelodeons and kinetoscopes. By this time they would be Nickelodeons and then real film theaters. They were concerned a fascination with images, particularly with close-ups. In fact, a number of film historians have said that one of the great changes in film history is the discovery of the power of the close-up face to convey a sense of attachment to the movie star, to people who began to be called matinee idols, interestingly. It's a wonderful book called Fame in the 20th Century by Clive James, in which he talks about the rise of the idea of fame. And he comments on the rise of the close-up. In early 1900s, the people in the movies were just little figures on the screen, smaller than the people who were sitting in the dark watching. But then something happened that turned 20th century fame into something else, the close-up. It made cinematography performers into stars. It could make anyone into a star. Larger than life, different from life, human faces took on more meaning than they had in reality. A new and strange relationship was established between those looked at and those doing the looking. It had something to do with eroticism, although the close-up brought the onlooker into a greater intimacy with the looked on than could be achieved by any lover, who would always have his imagination kept in check by the actual texture of a living thing. Radiant in the distance, yet close enough to taste, the people in close-up were symbolic. But what they symbolized was the people watching them. It was a way for the human race to worship itself in ideal form. It still is. It happens in public, but it's as private as self-love. And if it's one way, it doesn't feel that way. You know these people so well, you can't believe they don't know you. It's interesting to read film historians who, again, talk about the rise of a kind of both a kind of idolatry, a kind of a worship of these stars, and a kind of narcissism, a kind of fascination with one's own self. That's why I think this interesting study about YouTube and MySpace is an interesting development in this history. And the movie stars, the rise of the early stars, who were kings and queens of glamour, who were people who had great personality. That's another word you see in the description of what it takes to be a star. Not necessarily good looks, not necessarily good acting, but a great personality, being able to project a kind of persona. You can see that I'm skipping through a lot of material here because I did want to get to some material at the end of this talk to get back to the spoken word and to end to move away from the kinds of disorders that are promoted by a kind of obsession with the image. I have to share this from The Onion. Back in October, on the issue of celebrity. Us magazine is one of the kind of tabloidy. It's like it makes People magazine look like the Wall Street Journal. There's an announcement here, Us Quarterly, and the headline, New Us Quarterly to Explore Celebrity Issues in More Depth. Describing it as a discerning and literary companion to their flagship entertainment news magazine, Us Weekly editor-in-chief Janice Min announced on Tuesday the creation of Us Quarterly, a scholarly four times yearly journal dedicated to sizzling hot celebrity gossip. The Quarterly will feature in-depth essays, investigative pieces, and expert commentary on Hollywood's hottest megastars. Due to the demands of weekly publication, Us Weekly was only able to scratch the surface. The Quarterly is a dream come true for the more serious-minded star watcher who enjoys pictorials showcasing Mary-Kate Olsen's club-hopping wardrobe but craves a more critical examination of her hottest boots. Min estimated the first issue of Us Quarterly will be 300 pages long, will feature a thoughtful analysis of Lindsay Lohan's trouble on the set of Herbie Fully Loaded, a Michael Cunningham short story inspired by the TV season's nastiest celebrity feuds, and a 20-page treatise from Oxford literary critic John Bailey, mapping Ben Affleck and Jennifer Garner's romantic midnight Malibu beach stroll. The Quarterly will be a radical departure, this is the part I like best, from the magazine's largely visual format. Okay, it's mostly images, right? Quote, the new Us editorial direction moves away from these splashy paparazzi photos with brief captions toward food-for-thought essays, in-depth investigative pieces, and transcribed roundtable discussions. For regular Us readers who may have trouble picturing this new format, we'll try to think of how in a romance paperback the words build into continuous paragraphs, and you have to read them all in order to know what's happening. Well, that's what Us Quarterly will look like. wonderful moment describing this moment of image-based culture and the survival of the word. Let's explain what paragraphs look like. Yeah, the idea of a paragraph. In closing, I just want to say a couple words about poetry. Again, to bring us back to the verbal. Because I've had this theory for a long time. When I went to Westminster Seminary, before I went to seminary, they asked me if I'd taken any courses in philosophy or logic, and since I hadn't, I had to do remedial work when I came to seminary. But they never asked me if I'd taken any courses in poetry. And I think that was a great mistake. I really believe that it would be more important for seminary students to have a familiarity with poetry than with the history of Western philosophy. It's a radical thing to say, but there you are. I'm leaving on a plane soon, so I can say these things. Because, first of all, more of the scriptures have poetic elements in them than philosophical elements in them. And preaching is more of a poetic, or ought to be, more of a poetic enterprise than a philosophical enterprise. Now, philosophy is important, but poetry has a poetry is as Dana Gioia, who is a wonderful poet, said, this is language at its most intense. This is the verbal experience that we have at its most intense structure, its fullest sense. And I think it's no accident that so much of the scriptures come to us in poetic form, in part because of the fact that poetry builds its meaning through metaphor, through the recognition of likenesses, not a kind of logical precision of analysis. It's synthetic rather than analytic, and it recognizes likenesses. And as many people have pointed out, all of creation is rooted in likenesses. We are like God. A righteous man is like a tree planted by water that gives its fruit. God has made the world so that there are all these likenesses built into it that poetry and wisdom convey to us. I had someone make up a bumper sticker for me that says, "Poetry happens," which is actually a kind of statement. It's a theological statement, ultimately, because poetry happens because of the fact we live in a world where metaphors make sense. I love Psalm 1, and I happen to believe that when God made trees, he made the capillary action that takes moisture from the ground up through the trunk and into the branches and the twigs and into the leaves, that all of the way the tree works was intended by God as a metaphor for righteousness that shows up in that psalm. That's not some accident. It's not just some... I don't think it's an accident when we see those kinds of likenesses. And when Solomon reflects on trees and reptiles and fish, as we're told in 1 Corinthians 4, the reason that is a fruitful project is precisely because God has put that there. I'll share with you a quick story, and then I'll close. Several years ago, I had the good fortune of interviewing Richard Wilbur, who I think is one of the greatest American poets of the 20th century. And Wilbur said that the centrality of metaphor in poetry puts almost, and these are his words in the interview, puts almost every poet in danger of being religious. And I think this is something that that visual images don't do, because visual images don't work. They can be symbolic, but symbolic of what? You need interpretation to understand images. But poets are constantly making the likenesses clear. Poetry puts almost every poet in danger of being religious. If anything may be compared to something else, if the world can be seen as a linkage of similes and metaphors and figures, then poetry itself comes very close to declaring that all things are co-natural, that they are all of one nature. And that brings you to the threshold of saying that all things have a maker. I remember ages ago reading a final book of poems by Joseph Warren Beach, who claimed to be an atheist. And I took it around to him. He was in Cambridge at that time. And I said, "Joseph, look at these two lines. Don't you think they amount to a religious affirmation?" And he read them and said, Well, I can see that they do. I must say I seem simply to have submitted to the spirit of poetry at that moment. Now, Wilbur told me this story. It is an awesome thing to submit to the spirit of poetry. And the spoken word, in its highest modes of expression, have the capacities to reveal things to us in ways that images don't. I said Tuesday, quoted Eugene Peterson, saying, "It's the task of the Christian community to give witness and guidance in the living of life in a culture that is relentless in reducing, constricting, and enervating life." And I'd like to suggest, in light of that vision of ministry, that the church, in its work of discipleship, should proceed in three steps. First, it's important for us to identify the ways the culture around us has misshaped or misunderstood how to live well in God's creation. Not just theological errors, but dehumanizing disregard for the order of creation. And I would suggest a society that loses touch with language and poetry has lost sight of something important in the structure of things, in the way that God intended us to make our way in the world fruitfully. And second, the church in its teaching and discipling of its members should encourage the convictions and practices that are necessary to restore wholeness to life. So in my fantasy life, I imagine that on average, Christian people who honor the Word made flesh, will have, on average, more of an affinity for words and what they do in our lives. People who recognize God as creator will have more of an affinity for the poetic testimony to the integration of creation than secular people would. That's my fantasy life. And then third, motivated by the need to love our neighbors, to care for widows and orphans in their misery, and having demonstrated to the world the ways in which redeemed humanity is fulfilled humanity, then it's the obligation of the church to announce to the world by word and deed the true character of the false gods under whose captivity people are suffering. We don't want Christian celebrities just because the world has its celebrities, if the worship of celebrities is itself a problem. I regularly read very profound and informed critiques of contemporary cultural disorder by secular critics. Critiques from Christian sources are rarely both profound and informed. And more frequently, among influential evangelical leaders, is a willing embrace of cultural disorder as a way of showing the world how up-to-date followers of Jesus can be, as if that would be a good thing. The world is asking for bread, and we're giving a stone when we do that. And I wanted to focus just on this one theme of our fascination for images and the loss of a love for the great gift that word is. Pastors are in a remarkable position, since you speak all the time, to try to work to reverse that. Not in a castigating and scolding way. I would never present this to a congregation. But by your own life, by your own example, by the own practice that you have in your preaching.